The Southerners, by contrast, were downright deferential in normal circumstances, stepping aside with more than 9 feet to go. But if they had just been insulted, less than 2 feet. Call a Southerner an asshole, and he's itching for a fight. What Cohen and Nesbitt were seeing in that long haul was the culture of honor in action. The Southerners were reacting like Wicks Howard did when Little Bob Turner accused him of cheating at poker. That study is strange, isn't it? It's one thing to conclude that groups of people living in circumstances pretty similar to their ancestors act a lot like their ancestors. But those Southerners in the hallway study weren't living in circumstances similar to their British ancestors. They didn't even necessarily have British ancestors. They just happened to have grown up in the South. None of them were herdsmen, nor were their parents herdsmen. They were living in the late 20th century, not the late 19th century. They were students at the University of Michigan in one of the northernmost states in America, which meant that they were sufficiently cosmopolitan to travel hundreds of miles from the South to go to college. And none of that mattered. They still acted like they were living in 19th century Harlan, Kentucky. Your median student in these studies comes from a family making over $100,000, and that's in 1990 dollars, Cohen says. The Southerners we see this effect with aren't kids who come from the hills of Appalachia. They're more likely to be the sons of upper-middle management Coca-Cola executives in Atlanta. And that's the big question. Why should we get this effect with them? Why should one get it hundreds of years later? Why are these suburban Atlanta kids acting out the ethos of the frontier? Cultural legacies are powerful forces. They have deep roots and long lives. They persist generation after generation, virtually intact, even as the economic and social and demographic conditions that spawned them have vanished. And they play such a role in directing attitudes and behavior that we cannot make sense of our world without them. So far in Outliers, we've seen that success arises out of the steady accumulation of advantages. When and where you were born, and what your parents did for a living, and what the circumstances of your upbringing were like, all make a significant difference in how well you do in the world. The question for the second part of Outliers is whether the traditions and attitudes we inherit from our forebears can play the same role. Can we learn something about how people succeed and how to make people better at what they do by taking cultural legacies seriously? I think we can. Chapter 7. The Ethnic Theory of Plane Crashes. Captain, the weather radar has helped us a lot. On the morning of August 5th, 1997, the captain of Korean Air Flight 801 woke at 6 a.m. His family would later tell investigators that he went to the gym for an hour, then came home and studied the flight plan for that evening's journey to Guam. He napped and ate lunch. At 3 in the afternoon, he left for Seoul, departing early enough, his wife said, to continue his preparations at Gimpo International Airport. He had been a pilot with Korean Air for almost 4 years after coming over from the Korean Air Force. He had 8,900 hours of flight time, including 3,200 hours of experience in jumbo jets. A few months earlier, he had been given a flight safety award by his airline for successfully handling a jumbo jet engine failure at low altitude. He was 42 years old and in excellent health. At 7 p.m., the captain, his first officer, and the flight engineer met and collected the trip's paperwork. They would be flying a Boeing 747, a model known in the aviation world as the Classic. The aircraft was in perfect working order. It had once been the Korean presidential plane. Flight 801 departed the gate at 10:30 in the evening and was airborne 20 minutes later. Takeoff was without incident. Just before 1:30 in the morning, the plane broke out of the clouds and the flight crew glimpsed lights off in the distance.